It's been a long time coming, but now that a state takeover of Houston ISD is happening, questions remain about how it will unfold today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Vetting migrants has always been a talking point for President Trump. Now a new facility is giving border agents access to classified information they haven't had before. Texas voters passed a measure supporting tax money for parks. We'll look at how that money will be spent. Plus, remembering a Puerto Rican astrologer who crossed borders of all sorts. And have you ever felt a song is about you? Taking that to the next level today on The Standard. The fall weather gear is out in full force in the Texas Standard newsroom. We've got flannel, we've got layers, we've got sweaters. Some of us even pulled out the puffy jackets. I'm Laura Rice, and I hope you're staying warm during this Friday edition of the Texas Standard. Voters in Houston elected two new members of the HISD Board of Trustees on Tuesday and put four candidates in two other races in a runoff. Then Wednesday, the Texas Education Agency announced it's officially taking over that board. This was anything but unexpected. Houston ISD has a few schools with failing records and has gone through some very public drama. But Houston Chronicle K-12 education reporter Jacob Carpenter says there are still questions about what's next. He joins us now. Jacob, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly did we hear from the Texas Education Agency on Wednesday? How is the state planning to take over Houston ISD?
So the state announced that in a long-expected decision that they will be replacing the elected school board and choosing, in all likelihood, 9 people from the community to essentially take their place. And what that will mean is that the elected board members, they'll still retain their titles. Eventually, they could be phased back, or they will be phased back onto the board. But sometime, barring some state intervention or some unexpected development, barring a federal court saying that they can't enact this, the state will be appointing a board that in all likelihood will take power sometime late winter, early spring of 2020.
You've been following this for a long time. What changed in 2015 when it came to how the TEA could take over a school, and how are we seeing that in this Houston case now?
In 2015, state legislators passed a bill that's commonly referred to as House Bill 1842 that essentially said any school district that has any school, regardless of how big your district is, if you have one school that receives 5 consecutive failing grades under the state's academic accountability system, the TEA commissioner must either close that school or replace the school board. Now, in this case, Wheatley High School, it's a historic school, 92 years old. Many in the community there said that, you know, just closing the campus wouldn't solve anything, that it would harm the students. And we see that the commissioner felt that way as well, and felt that the best way of really solving this issue of low performance at Wheatley is to address the school board's inability to make the decisions needed to raise student achievement at Wheatley High School.
Well, this is really interesting. We're talking about poor academic performance at really one school in particular. Also, some controversies in involving trustees. But you've reported it really isn't all doom and gloom at Houston ISD.
No, and that's what makes this such a unique and very different case from really any other state takeover across the country. Not only is Houston ISD the 7th largest district in the country, it's really one of the better performing. You know, we typically have seen these state takeovers, it's been in places that we think of having some of the worst academics in the country, places like Philadelphia and Detroit and Camden, New Jersey. And in fact, you know, compared to its peers, Houston ISD is probably a slightly above average large urban district under the state's academic accountability system. It's a B-rated district. And really, this bill that started it was really authored and pushed through by a local Houston state representative who was sick and tired of seeing Cashmere High School and Wheatley High School continue to fail. And he said that the best way to make change is to really put pressure on the school board to make the changes necessary to improve student performance there.
So with this announcement, the TEA has really released a pretty detailed plan about how they want to appoint new members, although the timeline is questionable about how exactly that's going to be implemented. But I understand there's also still lawsuits up in the air. Do we know exactly what's next, or are some things still yet to be seen?
Sure. There are some knowns and a lot more unknowns at this point. The school board is actively suing the TEA. They are trying to get an injunction to stop this state takeover of the school board. There's a hearing on that scheduled for early December. And so from there, we may know whether the state can continue moving forward. It may take a little bit for a judge to rule on that. The state is moving full speed ahead for now, as long as the courts will allow it. And for now, we're estimating, barring any kind of major change or barring a legal order, the state has said that there will be an application deadline of January 2nd. And from there, we expect there will still be a couple months of work of interviewing candidates, screening them, putting together the right team of nine, and selecting a new superintendent, or I should say selecting a superintendent. It could be the interim is retained, or the commissioner under state law has to pick the superintendent. So there's a lot of moving parts, and we'll likely have a much better idea of how this works in the next few weeks.
Jacob Carpenter is the K-12 education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
National Vetting Center. You might have missed the president's call to have a location where the U.S. intelligence gathering agencies can share classified information with agencies of the government involved in immigration, including U.S. Customs and Border Protection and ICE. But it's currently up and running in suburban Virginia under the operation of the Department of Homeland Security. This has many immigration activists and civil rights lawyers raising their eyebrows. Investigative reporter Melissa Del Bosque looked into this controversy for ProPublica. Melissa, good to talk with you again.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So what information do border agents have right now when vetting migrants?
Well, right now they have quite a few databases and information that they're both collecting and sharing with other agencies. Much of that information is unclassified information, though, and now they're also being given access to classified information as well.
So when we say border agents will have this access, how low on the totem pole are we talking? Because this is very classified information that I understand hasn't been fully explored yet.
Right. Well, we're talking about agents at the ports of entry, Border Patrol agents, customs agents. The authorization for the National Vetting Center was given through a security memo from President Trump last year.
So where does this data collected by intelligence agencies go right now? And is anyone using it for border security?
Well, I'm sure it is being used for different security programs, the CIA, the NSA, the various intelligence agencies that collect information. They do counterintelligence, but typically they haven't shared that information with, agents like Border Patrol, ICE. These are law enforcement agencies and not spy agencies.
So I'm sure some people might see this and say, well, this is a great example of, walls that were up that need to be torn down. These agencies need to be communicating better and sharing this information across platforms. But what are the big concerns that have been raised?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, there are good reasons for wanting to streamline vetting and to add more types of information into the vetting process. But the issue that a lot of civil liberties and privacy experts and lawyers are bringing up is that since all of this is classified, we're not privy to what's being shared with immigration agents, how it's being shared. And the concern is that, well, there's no transparency for one thing, and the entire program is being administered by the Department of Homeland Security, which former CIA analysts I spoke with said that in the intelligence community, they're hesitant to have intelligence programs run by DHS because it's largely seen as an agency that's run by political appointees that are appointed by the president. Analysts would prefer the process not to be politicized. And so they're worried with DHS, which has had four secretaries in the last 3 years.
Right.
It doesn't seem like there's anybody there really running the ship, basically.
I think that politicization is an interesting point. It brings me to also wonder if perhaps the CIA and Customs and Border Protection or ICE might have different goals when it comes to using this information.
Well, I think so. Different missions, different goals. And, you know, some of the concerns that were brought up to me by former security analysts is, are they going to cherry pick this information to use it for political outcomes? For instance, targeting whole populations of people just based on their religion or, you know, what part of the country or world that they're from, and then not letting them in. If someone is denied entry, the concern is that information will be classified and there's no way to appeal it.
Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter for ProPublica. We'll link to her full story at texasstandard.org. Melissa, thank you again for your time.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Here in the studio with me now, social media editor Wells Dunbar. Good to see you this Friday.
Good to see you too, Laura. Hearing from folks about the story earlier in the program, the state takeover of the Houston School Board via Facebook, Debbie Sparks says, I'm so glad my daughter, a teacher, got out of Houston ISD after her first year of teaching. If she hadn't, I don't think she'd be the awesome teacher that she is today. Steve Ranson also refers to some problems afoot in the school district there, saying good riddance to the board members that the state looks to replace. However, Mike Boyd calls the move more Republican overreach, and that's an assessment that Janice Hitchcock echoes also on Facebook. She says, someone needs to remind Greg Abbott that he's governor of Texas, not king. Are we a representative republic or not? And speaking of Governor Abbott, lots of reaction to his announcement yesterday that he's designating 5 acres of state land in Austin as campgrounds for the homeless. I know we're going to have more about this later in the program, but we're already hearing from folks with lots of reactions and perspectives on this news. So I'll be back with that and more later in the show.
Great. We want to hear from you. You know how to let us know what you're thinking. You can find us on Twitter or on Facebook or email texasstandard@kut.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Proposition 5 passed easily on Election Day. 88% of voters approved the measure that would protect funds earmarked for Texas state parks and historic sites. Now comes the next part, spending that money. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has details about what's in the budget.
For Justin Rhodes, the passage of Proposition 5 means he can finally step off the fiscal carnival ride.
It gives us a sense of stability and funding, and gets us off that roller coaster.
Rhodes is the deputy director of Texas State Parks. The roller coaster he's referencing is how much money the legislature would allocate to his department. All of the sales taxes from sporting goods collected in Texas are supposed to go to his agency and to the Texas Historical Commission, but that hasn't always happened. In the nearly 2 decades Rhodes has worked for Texas Parks, state lawmakers have made a habit of raiding the department's budget to pay for other priorities. But Proposition 5's passage makes it harder for them to do that, which means a more predictable and a more ambitious parks and wildlife budget.
We have a list of projects, a list of priorities, and it gives us the ability to aggressively begin chipping away.
Many of those priorities are not glamorous. Many of the parks date back to the 1930s, with infrastructure to match. The state's parks are more popular than ever before. Rhodes says they're being loved to death, but they also have a backlog of over $800 million in deferred maintenance. So fixing and replacing infrastructure will be a major focus. Projects like replacing the wastewater system at Pardinalis Falls in the Hill Country, building a new headquarters at Tyler State Park, and repairing a communications building in the Davis Mountains. Just north of Houston, the boat docks and fishing piers at Lake Livingston State Park have needed to be replaced for years, but there just hasn't been room in the budget.
And the project's been on hold, and that's an example of a project that will be able to move forward.
And in addition to repairing and refurbishing current parks, Rhodes said that Proposition 5 could accelerate development of new properties. The department already has plans for two new parks that have been unopened for years because of financial restraints: Palo Pinto Mountain State Park, about 80 miles west of Fort Worth, and Albert and Bessie Kronkoski State Natural Area, 45 miles northwest of San Antonio. Those would be the first new parks the department has opened since 2012. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Weather events such as hurricanes and tornadoes are still largely considered acts of God. But as climate scientists warn of an increase in severe flooding, drought, and other disasters, companies have begun to worry about the risks climate change could pose to the state's economy. That economy, of course, is largely driven by production in the oil and gas sector, which is part of the reason Texas is the biggest producer of carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. Jesse Thompson is a senior business economist at the Houston branch of the Federal Reserve of Dallas. He wrote about the concerns that Texas's energy sector is raising over climate change in the Dallas Fed's quarterly publication. Jesse, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
Is it surprising at all that Texas energy companies are worried about climate change?
It's not surprising. Certainly, they're concerned about it in terms of their own business models, worried about climate regulation. And they're worried about, you know, the potential effects of increased storms. You know, we've got a lot of investment, a lot of capital along the coast in petrochemicals and refining that is going to be sensitive to storm surges and major flooding events. And of course, their workforce living in the area is going to be, you know, potentially subject to adverse effects from severe weather.
Well, you were touching on this already, but Houston, of course, was hard hit by Harvey, and just by sheer location is at risk for other hurricane-related storm damage, but it's also so core to our industrial complex. Is there concern that that needs to change?
I don't know that it needs to change. There's concern that it needs to change. If there's investment, certainly, that is being talked about to protect that infrastructure from a major weather event, if we were to have a substantial storm surge, you know, that salt water could do damage to that capacity, and that if that were to go offline, that would have significant impacts not only environmentally in the region, potentially if it was severe damage, but certainly economically. The supply, you know, 30% of our refining capacity in the nation is right here in the Gulf Coast. If that were to go offline, that would have an economic impacts across the nation.
We mentioned oil and gas. What other industries are you hearing a lot from on this issue?
Well, we're hearing a lot about it from just about every industry in the region that business leaders are thinking about. What do they need to do in terms of business continuity? What do we need to be thinking about in terms of risks to our capital, risks to our workforce, and how do we plan for this potential increase in this frequency of severe weather events?
Now, are a lot of these business leaders that you're talking to a little hesitant to use the words climate change, or are they grasping that's a term that they have become more comfortable with?
It varies, but regardless of the particular position that any individual might have on climate change or climate science, there's clear that the experience of the last few years has certainly driven home that this is something that they need to be considering, regardless of their thoughts about the cause.
So besides just being concerned, I guess, what steps are companies taking? Like you said, maybe upping their insurance investments and thinking about infrastructure changes to help better protect themselves?
I don't actually have a good answer to that question. As far as what firms are doing, certainly on the insurance side, more firms are, I think, are after Harvey, certainly are taking a hard look at flood insurance for their assets if they hadn't already. And certainly think in line with expectations about, you know, the redrawing of flood zones, the 100-year, the 500-year flood zones. We know that those maps are going to be redrawn soon. And so that's going to affect the demand for flood insurance and thoughts about where you might want to locate your business.
And so it's maybe not so much that that businesses that are currently there might move, but that those who would consider building in the Houston area might reconsider after something like a Harvey.
I think so. Now, shorter term, you know, these are, you know, these, I'd say the next several years, I don't think that the effects of this sort of decision making or this planning is really where the rubber meets the road. I think really what you're looking at is longer term. If these types of events do, in point of fact, ratchet up the way they are expected to, if these types of extreme weather events over time, you would see businesses really sort of and populations really sort of respond to that incentive and sort of moving to higher ground or maybe choosing not to locate to the state at all or to the Houston region at all. So longer term is where we really feel like the risks are. But longer term, there also might be policy responses in terms of investment in infrastructure, investment in flood control, investment in assets along the coast in order to protect our infrastructure.
Jesse Thompson is a senior business economist at the Houston branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Jesse, thanks again.
Thank you.
We are quickly coming up on 29 minutes past the hour Texas Standard Time, and that means the Texas Roundup is coming up next. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. A preventative regimen, including a healthy diet and exercise, can help prevent lung cancer. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas is getting a $50,000 fine starting today for not complying with a court order in a class action lawsuit over long-term foster care. U.S. District Judge Janice Graham Jack says the daily penalty will continue until court-appointed monitors confirm the state's providing 24-hour awake adult supervision for foster kids in group settings. Will Francis heads the National Association of Social Workers Texas chapter.
I think it's Judge Jack really saying, hey, where do you all want to put your money? Do you want to actually put it into the system and spend dollars on making sure that we've got the best and the safest facilities? Or do you want to give this money over to the federal government and show that you are not taking this as seriously as you should be?
The daily fine doubles in mid-November. Odessa residents are telling state lawmakers they want change following an August 31st mass shooting in the city that left 7 people dead. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden has more on a field hearing held Thursday by a House committee tasked with preventing future attacks.
Part of the testimony state lawmakers heard was how to tighten existing laws that could prevent gun violence. David Slayton is with the Texas Office of Court Administration. He pointed out holes in current policies like Texas judges being limited in their powers to order convicted criminals to get rid of their firearms.
The law currently, all it says is they shall notify the individual that they're no longer entitled to possess the firearm, but there's no law which says, and then they can order them to have to surrender the firearm.
Slayton says the court can only do so much when the laws they enforce limit their powers. The lawmakers didn't make any decisions at the end of the meeting and will continue to hold hearings across the state. The next one will be in El Paso this coming January. I'm Mitch Borden in Odessa.
The execution of a Texas death row inmate is being delayed for a second time, Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports.
Patrick Murphy was scheduled to die next Wednesday for his role in the 2000 killing of Irving police officer Aubrey Hawkins. The 58-year-old was one of the Texas Seven, a group of escaped inmates who also committed multiple robberies. Back in March, the U.S. Supreme Court first stayed Murphy's execution because the Texas Department of Criminal Justice did not allow a Buddhist chaplain in the death chamber with him, something that had been available to Christian or Muslim inmates. In response, the state barred all clergy from death chambers, and Murphy's execution was rescheduled. Now a federal judge has issued this latest stay because the state also refused to provide Murphy a Buddhist chaplain in the hours before his execution.
Sasha Cordner reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Kristen Cabrera.
And I'm Joy Diaz. Today, beloved astrologist Walter Mercado will be put to rest in his native Puerto Rico.
He had a career that expanded more than 50 years on TV.
But it was a career that almost didn't happen, right, Kristen?
Yeah. Okay, so imagine that you're at a TV station in Puerto Rico, yeah, and the normal person that does the daily horoscope calls right in sick.
But Walter was around, mm-hmm, because he was a telenovela actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so they asked him to fill in.
And he never leaves.
Yeah.
Do you know how many people
watched it? Almost like 120 million people in the U.S. and around the world saw his daily predictions.
Para que sepan ustedes que estamos abarcando al mundo entero directamente desde Checoslovaquia.
Mercado died last week at the age of 87. He was a very private man in his personal life, and that's why we believe the best person to talk about him is one of the few to whom he gave total access.
My name is Kareem Tapsch. I'm the co-director of Mucho, Mucho Amor, a forthcoming documentary about Walter Mercado. And I've had the pleasure of spending the last 3 years with Walter and his family in telling his life story.
Mucho, Mucho Amor is the phrase Mercado used at the end of every show to say goodbye to his audience.
Mucho, 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 mucho. Amor.
If you've never heard of Mercado, Kareem Tapsch, I believe, has the perfect description.
Imagine kind of like Mr. Roger meets Oprah dresses Liberace.
He wore tons of flowy, glitzy, mm-hmm, capes. And I think for me, it's kind of funny, Kristen, that, mm-hmm, you and I knew him, even though I'm much older than you. Much.
Not
and I grew up in Mexico.
Yeah, well, so I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley, and Tab, she grew up in Miami. And so, like, Walter Mercado, he was just ubiquitous in our culture.
So career-wise, he was very accomplished. Mm-hmm. Ballet dancer, we've mentioned already he was a telenovela actor. Mm-hmm. He went to school to be a psychologist. I didn't know that about him. But who was he to you?
Honestly, he's not just this, you know, pop culture icon of my heritage. He's a link to my grandparents who've passed, yeah, and the memories I share with them. And as millennial like myself, Tapsch talks about that cross-generational impact on a multicultural family.
I mean, as a young Latino, Walter Mercado's daily horoscope was a do not miss, must see tradition in our household. When Walter came on TV in the afternoon, our abuelitas and our moms would shut us up and sit us down and the family would watch. And I wasn't, turns out, the only one who had that experience. So many of my contemporaries grew up with that as well.
Another reason, Kristen, that I think he was so widely loved is because he embraced so many faiths and so many ideologies.
He took the best of Christianity, the best of Hinduism, the best of Islam and of Judaism, and from some of the smaller faiths like Santeria, and he blended all of those. And so when he spoke, everything was kind of influenced from these different belief systems.
Okay, just listen to his 2019 predictions right here.
Predicciones 2019. Ha llegado el amanecer de una nueva conciencia. Todo cambia.
Okay, so first he added, you know, 2019, and it gives you 12, right? And then he says the number 12 is everywhere.
Tenemos 12 apóstoles bíblicos.
12 apostles. We have 12 hours in a day, 12 hours in the night, 12 gods in Olympus. Hercules was given 12 tasks. Then he goes on to say, you know, 12, you add 1 and 2, that gives you 3.
Padre, Hijo y Espíritu Santo.
Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
Salud, dinero y amor.
Health, wealth, love.
He was also somebody who challenged perceptions of masculinity and femininity in a very machismo culture.
Right.
He was just himself.
He blended male and female energies, and he was androgynous.
And for Tapsch, it had a huge effect on him.
And so for myself, as a young queer person growing up, being able to see someone on TV who was different. I knew that I wasn't like every other boy, and while I didn't want to wear capes and jewels, I knew that there was somebody out there that was also different, and that was inspiring, and that our abuelitas could love him. They could also love us.
You know, despite being so influential, Walter Mercado was also dismissed by some and not taken seriously.
And that was most to do with either their own prejudices, whether they were faith-based prejudices, whether they were homophobia, which are things that he really contended with in his lifetime.
So throughout this week, there have been many, many memorial services in honor of Walter Mercado.
You know, it's still a little shocking to me. I can't imagine walking through the doors of his house and not seeing him, and some people leave, but their memory stays with you forever. Walter's going to be one of those people. There's never going to be another one like him, ever.
As for me, Kristen, I think I just want to wish our listeners peace, like Walter Mercado used to say.
Y mucho, mucho amor. I'm Kristen Cabrera.
And I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
My name is Max Petrie. I'm from Plano, Texas, and I'm currently a senior manager at Frito-Lay Research and Development. I was the lead developer on the Doritos Locos Taco. A Doritos Locos Taco is a hard shell taco made of Doritos. This process was about 2 years for us to completely identify the product we wanted to make, design a robust process, and deliver it to Taco Bell for launch. Taco Bell sold a billion Doritos tacos in just under 3 years. This made it the fastest consumer product ever to sell a billion units. For comparison, it took McDonald's 30 years to sell a billion hamburgers. When you put a brand in a product like Doritos, the expectations of what it's going to taste like, what the texture is going to be like, it's very hard to match that. We had to engineer the process to dehydrate the product in the plant and ship them already crunchy to match that Doritos crunch without breaking them in the process. We probably explored 50 or 60 different formulations in the plant. A broken Dorito is still edible, still tasty, still good. A broken taco shell is not functional. And basically, I guess it becomes Doritos. During our test market, people drove across the country to go get the product. They posted it on YouTube. There was a whole Facebook group dedicated to the desire to have these taco shells, and they showed them in different memes. It was so cool to see the consumer response and to see the delight that you brought to the consumers in the process. It'll probably be a moment in my career that I may not ever be able to top. It was wonderful. My name is Max Petrie, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Forty-two minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice. When music gets personal, there's often a fictional stand-in, like Eleanor Rigby, Roxanne, Bobby McGee, and Peggy Sue. But what if a song was truly written about you, about something you've done or experienced, perhaps your greatest hopes or deepest fears? That's the idea behind a new podcast launched in the Texas capital city today. You volunteer to confess something, anonymously, and then a band writes a song about your story. The Texas Standard's Leah Scarpelli has more on the podcast Song Confessional and the musicians behind it.
It's a hot summer day in Austin, and three friends and musicians, Walker Lukens, Zach Catanzaro, and Aaron Blackerby, get to work in their small vintage blue camper, parked outside UT Austin's Communication School.
It's kind of going on and off right now, the AC's
up. Podcast producer Aaron Blackerby is setting up for a handful of confessions today. The camper is small, and the afternoon temperature is climbing.
Yeah. I'm from South Texas, so it's just like
what's going to happen? My hair gets frizzier.
We're in the front of the camper now. There's a door leading into the back where the confessor sits. And yes, it's designed like a traditional Catholic confession booth. Battery-powered candles sit in one corner. Red window coverings give the narrow space a solemn, warm glow. A single mic hangs from the ceiling.
We have our trailer, and people come in, and there's like a partition, and they tell us the stories anonymously, and we record it.
Walker Lukens is who you might call the priest in this scenario. He's from Houston, now a well-known musician based in Austin, and creator of Song Confessional.
What I've realized is that everyone has something interesting to say. Like, no, definitely. Not everyone knows how to convey that to a stranger.
So Lukens welcomes the confessors, makes them feel at ease, asks them questions to move the story along. And the confession could be anything. A long-held secret, a prevailing emotion, recorded anonymously. It's then edited and sent to a musician or a band who writes a song about it. The idea for Song Confessional first came to Lukens a couple summers ago. He was getting burnout on touring, playing the same songs over and over, with only more of that to come.
I played this private show in Houston, and this woman came up to me afterwards and was like, I bought your first record 4 or 5 years ago, and it really helped me get through the loss of my mom.
Lukens was really moved by the woman's feedback, but also a little confused. For this record, he says, he hadn't written a single song about grieving.
And I just started thinking how interesting it would be to like make songs that mean something to people because they sort of tell you what it's supposed to mean.
Like this song called Ella, inspired by a man who simply confessed to how much he loves his wife. Back outside UT's communication school, the day's first confessor arrives at the camper.
Oh, are we ready to do this? Yeah, this is the fun part.
Once Aaron Blackerby makes sure a waiver is signed, everyone steps into place. Zach Catanzaro is recording at the kitchenette table behind the audio mixer. Walker Lukens sits near the confessor with a partition between them.
The good thing about this confessional is I have no judgment and literally no advice worth taking. So
the three friends take the process seriously, but also have a lot of fun with it. Zach Catanzaro owns the camper and plays drums for Walker Lukens. He says there's been good feedback from all sides.
Not only have we gotten such a positive response from the confessor side of things, but the musicians love it. It's a songwriting exercise. There's a time constraint. You have one day. You're given the source material. You know, you get to be creative. You get to do your own thing, but it's within a certain box.
Aaron Blackerby tells me that for the podcast, they also interview the bands.
Maybe this is like song journalism in some way, you know, bringing a whole bunch of like different aspects together with it. I think that's what Zach's always is like, we're doing journalistic work. I'm like, yeah, we are. Let's go to the Middle East.
Before that happens, they hope to take the camper to New York, the Midwest, lots of places, really. Far from where they first started at last year's South by Southwest Festival. They also want to recruit more bands, not only from Texas, but around the world. At today's recording session, there's one story that especially stands out to the guys of Song Confessional.
I've never really been here without them.
The volunteer is okay with her voice being used in the story. She's a mom who confesses her fear to be away from her children as they prepare for an upcoming trip.
And you know, the thing about that kind of terror is that every parent has it.
She says she's afraid that someday her children won't be under her watch anymore.
I am definitely like a helicopter parent. I hate to admit it. I'd like to be much cooler than that.
And she says she's relieved afterwards. And it was nice to process the terror she feels. The resulting song is called The Terror of Love by Austin band Sun June.
Something I couldn't do.
Walker Lukens, Song Confessional has taken him back to why he wanted to make music in the first place.
It just feels more in line with the original thing that I think I really connected with, which is just getting together and like making something new.
The podcast Song Confessional launches today. You can find it wherever you get your podcast. I'm Leah Scarpelli for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
I'm Sean Petrie. I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And the Typewriter Rodeo, we make up poems on the spot on whatever topic people want. Soup weather. That chill rolls in, the one that's been missing for most of the year, during the sweltering summers and the just mildly less sweltering early fall, when you barely even want to heat your coffee for fear of making the AC work harder. But now, settle in, slip on those fuzzy slippers and that soft flannel, and wrap your hands around that steaming bowl. Let the aroma take you and fill you up, because that's what good soup can do. Fill you, warm you, and just soothe you, all with one sip. For the Texas Standard, I'm Sean Petrie with the Typewriter Rodeo.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem, of course, comes to us from our friends at the Typewriter Rodeo. If you've got an idea for a topic, let us know. Send us your requests on social media or email us, texasstandard@kut.org. And before we say goodbye for the week, we've got to recap the week in Texas politics. Here to help us do that is Texas Tribune reporter Emma Platoff. Emma, good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking a lot on this show about Austin's changing laws affecting people experiencing homelessness and Governor Greg Abbott's uninvited involvement in that. Abbott now saying he's providing a 5-acre solution. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So yesterday, after, as you described, some kind of back and forth between the city of Austin and the state of Texas, the governor's office announced that he would provide temporary living space for Austin's homeless in a 5-acre plot of state land off of Highway 183 near Montopolis Drive.
Well, this seems like a great solution for Austin, but of course, homelessness is not just a challenge here. Will this be something the governor is planning to do in other cities?
We haven't heard anything from him yet on plans in other cities. What we do know is that this is sort of a stopgap measure. A group of Austin businesses came together yesterday and announced they hope to raise $14 million to build a 300-bed shelter somewhere near the city center. Mm-hmm. So we have that coming up ahead. But we haven't really heard much else from the governor as far as plans in other cities.
Well, and you rightly point out that location is key here, and also questions of permanency. And so a great solution, at least an opportunity for helping, but also folks questioning his motives in this all along.
Yeah, and some of my colleagues were out in the field yesterday speaking with folks experiencing homelessness who sort of pointed out some concerns about the location, pointing out the distance from bus routes, you know, the challenges they may have in getting back downtown for doctor's appointments and that right. type of thing. So we'll have to see sort of how this pans out.
In other news, one of two Texans running for president dropped out last Friday, former congressman from El Paso, Beto O'Rourke. That leaves former HUD Secretary Julian Castro in the race, if we're not counting Marianne Williamson here. Any idea if Castro will make this month's debate stage?
It's an uphill climb, certainly, for the former San Antonio mayor. He has the number of unique donors he needs to make the debate, which is set for November 20th outside Atlanta. But so far, he has none of the polls he would need to make the threshold. And the deadline for that is nearly approaching. It's mid next week. So an uphill climb there.
Is he hoping to, I guess, bank on those who were supporting Beto, kind of switching gears and supporting Julian now? I know he's gotten some of the endorsements that Beto had originally.
Yeah, that certainly would be a good avenue for success for him. As you point out, you know, some Texas state lawmakers have shifted their support from Congressman O'Rourke back to Secretary Castro. I think whether those numbers sort of follow him in the polls remains to be seen. And of course, we know that before O'Rourke dropped out of the race, he wasn't pulling in too much support in the polls either. Mm. So,
Emma Platoff is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. Emma, thank you and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And it's time once again to check in with social media editor Wells Dunbar, who's got a look at the talk of Texas.
You know it, Laura. You know I do. Well, dovetailing off what we just heard, your conversation there about this ongoing situation in Austin with the issue of homelessness mm-hmm. and the sort of back and forth we've seen between the city and state leaders. Lots of people chiming in about what you just discussed. This announcement from Governor Greg Abbott that he's found 5 acres of state land on which to basically invite people experiencing homelessness to camp. Mm-hmm. Also says there's going to be like portable porta potties and some agencies delivering food and stuff. So lots of opinions about this on our Facebook page there. Gabe Gatesick says that housing is only part of the problem, and it's the part they want to fix because if you tuck people away somewhere, they're out of sight. But you actually haven't fixed anything. If you're truly committed, you can start additional programs for things like drug use recovery, job assistance, and healthcare. Don't just stop at housing. Mm-hmm. James Exum says this is much better than just sending in the police and city workers to throw out the few belongings people may have. It should have been the first intervention. Meanwhile, Jerry Harp calls this move a band-aid on a chronic problem. Mm-hmm. He says, I guess it will hide people for a while. I wonder how many people are homeless due to medical bankruptcy. And Don Richardson says, if the governor really wants to help, he could take state money and put these people in something like motels for a year, help them get jobs and medical help. Problem solved for a year. Mm. And, you know, that is the solution we've seen in, you know, there's many ways to combat homelessness. And that's one sort of, I guess, maybe a sort of simmering issue in the background mm-hmm. of the state and the city conflict is how best to address it. I know progressive cities like to see sort of housing first policies. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've really seen that from Austin yet. I know they've made great, great strides in getting homeless veterans off the street.
Yeah.
But obviously an issue that people are continuing to talk about and one that we continue to talk about because it's a really hot issue.
Yeah, I was in Boston a couple years ago and they really were one of the first cities to really try to, they had a homelessness czar and I asked her, you know, how do we actually solve the homelessness problem? Because despite their efforts there, it's still an issue there. And she said, there's got to be no barriers to entry, which is hard for some people to support, you know, if there's no requirements for rent or getting clean or whatever else, you know.
But that's a conservative political climate like Texas, so definitely. Continuing to hear reactions to that story from the top of the show about the Texas Education Agency and their takeover of the Houston School Board, folks chiming in about the record of the TEA itself. Lisa Flores calls it ironic for the TEA to lament a failure of governance in Houston when the agency didn't fire a single person who helped perpetuate an illegal cap on special education for 14 years, referring to that controversial decision, essentially setting an arbitrary amount for the number of special education students that would be served. So, you know, I wish we could go out on something fun on Friday, but sometimes the news just isn't all that fun.
Well, here's something that's a little bit fun. Wells and I are sporting our flannel today, as I mentioned at the top of the show.
There is a pretty styling pic on the Texas Standard Twitter account.
We're kind of cute. Check us out on Twitter. We are at Texas Standard, and you can also find us on Facebook. See you back here on Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.